Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome to XYZ, the podcast for anybody interested in CNCing, machining, that kind of stuff. Hosted by myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, and my esteemed colleague. The show would be nothing without him. It's Aaron Goff. How are you, Aaron?
Going good, mate. How about you?
Good. Yeah, good. I haven't done much work this week, which is probably why I'm feeling so good.
Slack bastard. What have you been up to?
Not slack. I've been super, super busy with sort of house stuff and admin stuff, and we had to go to the city yesterday to have our interview to allow us to stay in the country, our sort of residency interview.
Right.
So yeah, there's been a little bit of worry over that the last sort of few months, I suppose. But that went really well, and you know, they do the whole take the fingerprints and everything. They treat you like a criminal, basically.
Wait. So you just bought a house, and like you own the place that you currently live in, right? Too, right?
Yes. Well, we own.
And you're not even like a permanent resident in France.
Our babies were born here, and they're not residents even.
That's funny.
Yeah. So
you're brave, buddy. You're brave. I wouldn't have done that.
When they're 18. They can then apply for to be a French citizen, just because they were born here doesn't mean they are. Because as with British parents, our babies are British. Right. It's crazy. So we still have to apply to if we're successful this time, which I'm sure we will be. There's no reason why we wouldn't be. We still need to apply every 5 years to stay in the country, which is bonkers.
Yes, I've been through all that myself. Like permanent residency in Canada is better. All you need to do is reapply for your card.
Yeah.
Like you automatically have permanent residency forever, but you have to get a new card every 5 years. That's it.
Right. Okay. That's not too bad. But you know, especially here where I live in the Dordogne, which we're sort of smack bang in the middle of France, like the furthest away from a beach you could possibly be. There are so many Brits and Dutch, Germans, there's so many people here. And if it weren't for these people living in areas like this, because we're pretty rural and remote, the towns they'd just collapse because, you know, there's not enough French people here to support the businesses, that kind of thing. Right. So, yeah, it's a really weird one. But aside from that, I've become a sort of accidental sign writer for the village. Because of this shitty little CNC, when I first had it, I made a few signs, sort of practice in doing things, and a few people have seen them. They're like, "Oh, would you mind just making me a sign saying this? Would you mind just making me just a little sign just for this?" And you know, they're all sort of favors for people, I suppose. But accidental sign writer. I think that needs to go on the CV, maybe on my LinkedIn profile.
Is the little machine still working well?
Perfectly well. I'm over the moon with it. And I've been cutting G10 with it this week too, with just standard bits. I call them bits. That's how little I know.
End mills,
cutting tools that it came with, you know? And I'm just really, really impressed. It's just doing the job. You know, it's nothing special. I take things very, very slowly with it. But, you know, like we've said before, it allows me to do something else while that's happening. So it doesn't particularly need to be quick.
Right.
I'm just really, really pleased with it. It's now got an official place in the workshop, whereas before it was sort of plonked on my bench. Play with it till it breaks. Then that's what generally happens with the cheaper tools. But this one now, I've welded up a little cart for it. It's got its own space, and it's a permanent addition.
Right. So for those newer to the show, Craig bought it's a 3040, right?
It is, yes, yes.
Yeah. So it's a Chinese-made 3040 CNC router, you know, with a...
It's a shitty little CNC, as we call it.
Yes, we call it the shitty little CNC. But you've also bought a Onefinity Machinist CNC router. Where is that?
That won't be coming for... I think there's probably another 4 weeks left.
Oh, wow.
I think it was 8 or maybe 12 weeks ordering time when I ordered it.
It's funny. I'm like, oh, that's so slow, but like... People that have ordered my knives previously have waited like 12 months.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's on its way. But in the meantime, this thing has done a cracking job, and I can imagine I'll still use it sort of side by side with it.
Right.
A good reason for that is it's got a really small spindle. So the collet is really small. So you can use very thin end mills. So, for example, with the folding knives that I got, the Elferin that I can get, which is the synthetic ivory for the handles, it comes in very small strips. So if I were to use a quarter-inch end mill, there'd be so much wastage. I wouldn't get much out of the strip. So, yeah, because these are 3 mil thick.
The Onefinity machine, what does that come with, the fur spindle?
I think it's a quarter-inch, and I'm not sure...
Is it a router?
That's it is. It's the Makita or Dewalt Walter that you put in, router that you put in.
So you can get two things. You can get replacement collets for the Dewalt routers, and usually they come, and the Makita ones too, and you can get like 1/8 collets.
Yeah.
So 3 mil. And then you can get reducers as well, like little sleeves that go inside the collet that have a smaller inner diameter, so you can use a smaller end mill if you need to.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, this shitty little CNC does that job, and I've been cutting the Elferin with it as well. And because it's only 3 mil that I'm cutting, because these are just, you know, outer scales for a folding knife. So there's the that sort of the inner scale, if you like, which is the rigidity. This is just the decal, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And it cuts very, very well, very, very little wastage, and I'm really happy with it. Oh, did I tell you I bought one of those really, really shitty again? There's a theme here. Like handheld pendants, you know, that you can control it with.
Yes, you did. Has that been working out?
Very well. Very well. Yes.
So Craig's talking about like a handheld controller for the CNC with a little jog wheel and everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, has the jog wheel been as transformative for you as I thought it would be?
Yes, really well.
Yeah,
it just speeds things up, and it's cool to play with too.
It is.
One thing that I'm not using with this, and any sort of machinists out there, they're going to go what? Because obviously the accuracy isn't. It won't be the best. I'm not using the Z probe to take to zero off, simply because I find it quicker because I'm cutting all the way through this material.
You put it on the top of the material.
Cookie cutter in it, yeah. So I'll turn the spindle on, or bring it down till I can hear it sort of just touching. That's my zero and I'm away.
That's fine.
Yeah, and it works really fine. So yeah, I'm really pleased, and I don't regret the purchase at all, and it was extremely cheap, so yeah. It's all good.
One good thing to do with CNC routers with the spindle touch off is actually to touch off on your spoil board and to do all of your models with the bottom as the zero, because then you can cut through exactly to the spoil board.
And leave
tabs of a very precise thickness at the bottom. You can leave tabs, like tiny little tabs, you know, 20/1000ths of an inch that are just like break by hand, as opposed to having to cut them out.
I've been doing all of this, cutting right through without tabs too.
And the parts are just like popping out?
Yeah, well, I'm using tape. I'm using tape on the spoil board, tape on the material, and then I'm using like a neoprene gel to basically glue the tapes together.
Neoprene gel. What the hell is
neoprene
that?
Gel, and it's like a contact adhesive, so immediately as you put it down, it's rock solid. It's not going anywhere. So as soon as I press it down, I can start machine. It's just super fast.
So you're putting a layer of masking tape on the bottom of your material. A layer of masking tape on your spoil board, and then taping the masking tape gluing the masking tape together with the contact cement.
Exactly. Yes. Hmm. Yeah.
I've seen that done with super glue, but I've never heard of it being done with contact cement.
Yeah, it's just super fast, and you know, everything holds. That cutting without any tabs. And what I'm with these folders, I mean, they're very small folders, so the actual scales are pretty small as well.
Right.
So that they're not flipping out. It's working like a charm. Working
nice. You can't ask for better than that.
No, exactly. With regards to other shitty machines that I have, my laser is broken. It still is broken, rather. We talked about power supplies and finding more local power supplies rather than finding them in China. And I sent you a link to the power supply as well, and I couldn't find it, and you couldn't find any. They seem to be pretty specific for fiber lasers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it turns out that the power supply in that machine, so it has four rails, plus and minus 15 volts, 12 volts, and 24 volts.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just a very unusual power supply. So, I mean, you could, as I said to you, you could replace it with multiple power supplies, small ones.
Yes, and have some sort of Frankenstein machine, yeah. But I mean, I've spoken to the manufacturer in China, and they were actually sending one via a plane, as opposed to sort of shipping via a ship, yeah.
Right.
And I should be getting it within 3 or 4 days now. And literally just within the hour, I've actually had a message from FedEx telling me that I need to pay them before they'll send it to me. But
why do you have to pay it? It's a replacement part, zero cost.
Yeah, I'm not paying for the part. I'm paying for the import tax.
No, that's what I mean. What
sales tax?
But you didn't pay anything for the part. Why is there sales tax?
I know, but it's still something with a value coming into the country, which has duty on it.
So. Oh, that's stupid. The supply. Whenever I have to, thankfully, rarely, if I have to send a replacement for something, I always mark it as zero value warranty.
Ah, right. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm finding I get a lot at the moment. So, little things like Knife Talk, which is the other podcast that I do. We quite often get sort of gifts from sort of sponsors, that kind of thing, or they'll they have a new machine and they'll say, well, can we send you one, and you talk about that kind of thing, which is fine, which is great, I'm all up for that, but they generally come from the US, so the other two sponsors, the other two hosts, Jeff and Miracle, they love it because we're getting free shit. I get free shit, but then I get a huge bill afterwards.
Right.
It's like, right. And we've had a few occasions where even listeners have sent me like little gifts. And I didn't ask for them. Most of the time I don't particularly want them because, it's one of those things. But they also come with a bill. So it's like sending a stranger a bill. And it's like, lovely.
Yes, I've had that before too. I mean, I stay away from that kind of stuff mostly, but I had one of my suppliers... knife kits they sent me. Apparently I've sent them a lot of business and I didn't even realize I was doing it with one of my... I have like a how to make a Kydex sheath video on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
And I link to a whole bunch of their stuff and they were like, oh, you've been sending us a lot of customers. I was like, oh
wow.
So they sent me some material that they were trying out. It's like an alternative to Kydex. And as you said, I they sent it to me for free and then I got like a $120 bill from FedEx and I was like, oh,
I didn't ask for this.
And I haven't used any of it. That's the funny thing. It's all in colors I'll never use. So I paid, $120 for something I'll never use, which is maybe I should do a giveaway or something. It's like,
So what's been going on with you this week?
I actually started work on a folding knife as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And that drove me to, I did a couple of little 3D printed kind of how does it feel in the hand prototypes.
Yeah.
And then, because it's quite small, the parts coming off my filament printer look very crude, and I had to drill out the holes before I could fit pins in and all that kind of stuff.
I can see where this is going.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, my girlfriend, she was laughing at me. Yeah, exactly. So I was like, well, maybe I should be looking at a resin printer. And my girlfriend was like, of course you need a new thing. So, it's kind of interesting. Like the last time I looked at resin printers was a couple of years ago and they were really slow and really expensive and really stinky and the materials were all kind of shit.
Hmm.
And a lot of that has changed. So the other use that I would have for a really accurate 3D printer is to potentially 3D print my sheaths for my Resolute knives. And, I've always thought of resin printers as being very slow. But the interesting thing is that most of the inexpensive printers now use an LCD screen as they basically what they do is they use it as a mask. So they have a UV light underneath, and then they have an LCD screen, and the LCD screen can either be dark or transparent. Mm. And basically, they shine the UV light through the transparent sections of the screen, and that cures the resin at the bottom of the vat, right? To produce
like a screen
one layer,
basically.
Yeah, you're kind of screen printing thousands of layers, you know, to make your 3D object.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that is it doesn't matter how full your layer is. Each layer takes the same amount of time, regardless of how many things are in that layer.
Mm, yeah.
So, just to print one part, the resin printer is way slower than a filament printer. You know, for me to print a sheath on my filament printer is like 3 hours, and to print one sheath on the resin printer would be like 9 hours.
Right, yeah.
But if I fill the build platform, then I can print 4 or 5 sheaths in the same time. Yeah.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, it's much faster. So, yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that previously. And the interesting thing is, too, that that's not an advantage that applies to expensive resin printers. Because expensive resin printers use a scanning laser, kind of like your laser engraver.
Hmm.
How it moves the laser point around in 2 axes, you know? So that means the more stuff you have on a layer, the more time it takes to scan that layer. So the expensive resin 3D printers, and they, you know, they're like $5,000 US, $7,000 US, like they're not cheap. They don't have that same advantage of being like a fixed time per layer, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been a fun journey looking at all the different resins and nerding out about different printers and stuff. It's always fun to buy new things.
So have you bought one?
Not yet.
Particular model in mind?
Yeah, there's 2 that I'm considering. The Elegoo Mars 2, which is a funny name, but that's like $250 US.
Wow.
Per printer.
I've mentioned him, I think maybe for the last 2 or 3 episodes, but Bob at I Like to Make Stuff, which is a YouTube channel and stuff, he's a huge fan of these. He does a podcast with Jimmy DiResta and Dave Picciuto, and it's called Making It. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about this exact printer to the point where both Dave and Jimmy, the co-hosts, they ordered one online as he was talking about it. They were like, well, if it's that cheap, I'm going to buy one now. You know, he's a huge, and he's got a couple of them, I know, as well. But yeah, huge fan of them.
Yeah, and so the Mars 2, like the original one has... So basically what they were doing previously for the LCD screen that they're using as like the mask in the bottom of the printer. Previously they were just using like screens out of like tablets, cheap tablets or cheap iPhones or whatever. So it was actually a color screen. But you don't want color because you just want black or white.
Yeah, it's either shade or not. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what was happening with the older screens is that only the blue pixels, which is 1/3 of the screen, were allowing the UV light through. And that was like... It meant that it took like 8 seconds to cure a layer. But the newer printers, like the Mars 2 and some of the frozen printers and stuff, they actually have monochrome screens. So they're just black and white. Mm. And that lets a lot more light through. So now the printers are significantly faster. It's like 2 seconds a layer rather than 8.
Wow.
Okay. So yeah, it's as I said, it's just been super interesting. And the level of detail that these things can do is nutty. Like that $250 printer can print features down to 50 microns.
Wow.
In X and Y, and 10 microns in Z. Like, that's
so is,
the,
is this
tiny.
Really required for a basic model of a folding knife, which you may not have put into production anyway?
Well, I'm definitely going to put something into production, whether it'll be this exact one or
okay.
not. But the interesting thing about using like a really high resolution printer for that is that you can print things like threads, right?
Yes.
I can print like a handle with threads in it and then take like actual hardware, you know, like metal bolts and stuff, and thread them right into the handle and assemble, you know, a fully working object, you know, a fully working print. And that really tiny resolution means that like things like holes and stuff are way more likely to come out the size that you expect them to. So, you know, whereas with a filament printer, like, as you know, it's really like, it's a very close approximation, but it's not, you know, not the same. Reproducing things like textures, and even like little cutouts and stuff can be pretty dicey. Whereas on a resin printer, it's just, you know, it's going to come out.
With resins, can you get things like flexible filaments? You still can too.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it used to be that there was like the resins were pretty shitty. You know, they looked good, but they were very brittle. And you know, relatively few selections, and they're very expensive too, you know, $100 a liter or whatever. But now you can get like the standard types of resin that are, you know, fairly durable, different colors and that kind of stuff for like $25 a liter or $25 a kilogram.
I know Amazon do their own brand, don't they?
I haven't seen the Amazon one.
Yes, I was looking the other day at just, you know, normal filaments, and I come across the resins as well, and Amazon have got their AMS brand, they call it an AMZ brand.
Okay, of course. Yeah, and, you know, but then they also have, like, resins that are designed to simulate ABS, so, you know, a more durable kind of functional plastic, and then you can get flexibles, you can get, you know, clear ones, and then one of the interesting things is that you can actually mix the different types of resins together, too. So if you want, you know, you want something flexible, but not quite as flexible as the, like, flexible resin that you bought, you can mix a little bit of the standard resin in there to get 50-50 properties, you know. Or mix your own colorants, like, just buy clear resins and then mix your own colorants and dyes into it.
Nice.
To get whatever color you want. Or glow-in-the-dark powder, or, you know, it's really interesting, all of the different stuff you could do with it.
Yeah, proper sort of recipes. You can, cook up your own batches. Lovely.
So
and so you're talking you know, $250 for the Elegoo Mars 2. I'll make sure we put links in the show notes for all these.
Oh, we should make them affiliate links.
Yes. The extra work that goes into that is like, oh really?
Oh fine, I'll do it. I'll take the affiliate money.
You go for
it. Yeah, it's crazy how inexpensive they are. It really is. Like, you know, I haven't got one of those yet, so I can't vouch for it. You know, that's the only reason I wouldn't put an affiliate link on it is I'm not vouching for it yet, you know.
Yeah.
But lots of people have these printers and speak really highly of them, so.
So what's the process? So it'll build up the layers. You're then left with an object. Is that ready to go, or does that need sort of post-processing in any sort of way?
It does need post-processing, So after it comes out of the printer, it's squishy and covered in goo, and, you know, like, so basically some of the resin will adhere to the outside of the print because it's, you know, basically been submerged in this, like, you know, gooey liquid. Yeah. So you can drain as much of it off as you can, but then you have to wash it. The traditional washing fluid is isopropyl alcohol. You basically, like, submerge the whole thing in there and whisk it around and get all the excess resin off. Some people have been using, like, the Mr. Clean cleaning solution as a cheaper and apparently in some ways better alternative. But an ultrasonic cleaner is the ideal. You know, you chuck it in an ultrasonic cleaner full of, like, the Mr. Clean stuff and then leave it for a couple of minutes and come back and you've got a nice clean pot, and then it needs to be finish cured. The UV is like, the resin is UV cured. And when it comes out of the printer, it's like partially cured, like 50% cured. So then you just need to expose it to UV light for, you know, 10 minutes to finish cure it.
Right. Okay.
And you can do that honestly just by leaving it in the sun. But that's pretty variable and it'll probably get one side more than the rest and so on. So they have these little, like, you know, spinning turntable UV light deals that you can put your pot in.
Okay. And what sort of cost are you looking at then for, I mean, you're talking $250 for the printer.
Mm-hmm.
What are these extras then?
It's pretty funny actually. Like the, you know, the little washing station with the UV lights, like, you know, $160 as well, and then you've got the resin. So, like, my Amazon cart has the Mars 2 printer, a little washing station, and like two bottles of resin, and it's like $600 Canadian. You know, so that'd be like
they got you.
Yeah, seriously. You know, that's like 500-ish US. So yeah, there's definitely extra stuff that you need, but if you were setting up a little print farm, you probably only need one of the washing station, one of the curing station, and then you could just add printers.
Yeah. Okay, so, makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like a really, for prototyping especially, where you want like really accurate parts, it seems like a pretty good deal. But we'll see. We'll see.
If we go back to you prototyping your folding knife, mm-hmm. and you were saying, you know, with holes, you'd maybe have to drill them out with a regular sort of filament printer and so on.
Yeah.
That is pretty much what I did when I was prototyping my folding knife. Pretty much exactly the same. I've got a bit of a question there. So mm-hmm. let's say you've designed your model, your STL file, which then goes through whether it's Cura Slicer or Prusa Slicer, whatever you're using. The infill that you decide, so that will give you a almost like a waffle like structure inside.
Yeah.
So I mean, for anybody out there who hasn't done any 3D printing, it's unusual to have a solid plastic object. You normally have some sort of shell inside, which is structurally sound and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you, in the actual design of it, so before it's sliced, so in your design software, let's mm-hmm. say you had solid pieces where you knew you're going to drill out, or sort of collars maybe around the holes that you were doing, so you could ream them afterwards, that kind of thing. When it comes to them being sliced, would they take that into account, or does it look at the final shape and then simply just slice that up? It doesn't know what's going on the inside. Do you know what I mean?
Kind of. I mean, so like I, you know, have holes in the design where I'm going to drill holes.
Yeah.
And the holes are in the design, they're like the actual size that I would want them to be. And yes. then usually they'll print so that the holes are a little tight. And then I just drill the holes out to the final size. Yeah. And so when it goes through the slicer, it knows that the holes are there, and it'll put a couple of perimeters, like solid circles around the hole.
Around that hole, yes.
Yeah, so there's always enough material there to drill out.
Yeah, I get that, but what I'm wondering is if in the design stage you wanted maybe a certain area to be, if we forget about the holes for now, just, you know. Mm-hmm.
If you wanted it to be solid and then to drill through.
Exactly, you know what I mean? Yeah. Would the slicer take
Yeah, there's not really a way to...
shape?
Right.
Sorry, go on, sorry.
So I think in Prusa Slicer, you can set rules to like an area of the print. So you can make like a little cylinder in the slicer and move that around inside your object, and then say, within this cylinder, I want everything to be 100% solid.
Okay. Okay, so you can have sort of zones for your infill and... Okay, but it wouldn't take that into account from the initial design file.
No. Like,
wow,
there's not really that level of communication between your CAD software and the slicer. You would have to set that up manually in the slicer.
So it almost sees your final sort of render, the sort of external dimensions and the external shape, then just slice that up as it sees fit. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just something I was wondering. It's not really important for anything. I was just wondering how it works.
No, that's a good question. Yeah, and I mean, it's part of the attraction with a resin printer too is just that like printing really small parts is much easier, you know. So with a folding knife in particular, you know, so I'm trying to mess around with like a button locking mechanism or like a bolt action lock, which are both kind of, you know, quite small, intricate parts. There's going to be lots of bits that are smaller than, you know, 3 millimeters. And so on a filament printer, you know, as you know, like printing stuff that small is just not the greatest experience. Whereas on a resin printer, it's no problem at all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
$250, so, you say?
Seriously. Yeah. And
I don't have the workshop space for anything else.
but they're pretty small. They're pretty small. Put it in the baby's room.
Then a cure. Yeah. Just sell one of them. We got two. Sell one.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, one of the other interesting things is, too, like, they're starting to come out with, you know, because, like I said, they're using, like, an LCD screen as the mask, right? So they're starting to come out with models that have 4K LCD screens. But it's 4K resolution on, like, a 6-inch screen. You know, wow. Like, the pixel density is crazy. And the smaller those pixels are, the smaller the spots of resin that you can cure.
Yeah, so, and the more, sort of,
detailed.
Sharper. That masking would be, I suppose. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So like those 4K ones. So there's one another one I'm looking at called the Frozen Sonic Mini 4K. They have amazing names, these printers. But that one can do details down to 35 microns in X and Y. So at that level, you can start to like reproduce. You know, I think you could probably do this with the Elegoo Mars as well. Like, you can reproduce textures on the surfaces of your models, which is something you really can't do with, like, a filament printer.
Hmm.
You know, so, like, with Kydex, the plastic that we use for our sheaths, you know, that has that kind of leathery, wrinkled surface.
Yeah, sort of stippled, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it looks great. It hides wear and stuff. You could totally reproduce that kind of a surface with a resin printer, whereas with a filament printer, you know, not really.
Yeah.
I'm really curious whether I'll be able to find a resin that will let me print functional parts.
Mm.
Because if I could, then like printing sheaths that way would be really nice.
Yeah. Wow. But I mean, this just goes to show, doesn't it? You said you looked a few years ago, and you were talking sort of $5,000-$6,000 US, and now, you know, $250.
Yeah.
There were cheaper
resin printers a couple of years ago, but they were shit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like they weren't great. Whereas now, like, you know, how many different types of printer do you want? Right? There's tons. So yeah, sorry, what you were saying, just that it's crazy how it's advanced.
Yeah, yeah. And that boils down to everything. I've been looking at I shouldn't be. Looking at guitars again this week.
I think
I'm going to have more rooms in this new house and I need more guitars to put in.
My dad is like this too. Every time I talk to him.
You never know when inspiration will strike. That's the way I'm going to... So I've been looking and I just want to get something, like for the bar area, I just want to get something cheap that, you know, because everybody's going to pick it up and play it and all that kind of thing. So I just want something cheap. And I was looking. I remember like cheap guitars used to be cheap, you know, in the very word of cheap. They'd be awful to play, they'd be really high action on them, and they'd be terrible. But now you can get like amazing guitars super, super cheap, you know, and it's just crazy how the manufacture of everything has come to be so much cheaper. But what I have found, this is going off on a complete and utter tangent now, is software. The more I'm getting into sort of machining and sort of more sort of, I suppose, specialized stuff, I'm finding software prices are crazy. You know, we're used to, you know, we're used to, you know, the 69 pence app, you know, on your phone.
That
kind of thing, you know, I mean, and things changed back when that, you know, the iPhone was introduced and people were getting, you know, software for pennies and, you know, it was all a numbers game. You know, if you can get 5 million people to download it and it's a penny, it's a lot of money. But when it comes to specialist stuff, it obviously doesn't work that way. That economies of scale doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been lots of software that I've wanted to try and use. And I found that the murky underworld of knockoff software, and I'm not going to say where it is. I'm sure people know where they can get stuff. But this is almost, it seems to me, like a legit site because it's where I go to buy hardware for stuff straight from China. I think we all know exactly what I'm talking about. But they do software too, which is obviously knocked off. It's not,
right. You
know, the legit software. But the fact that you can just put it into your cart and pay with your card at the end and you get a little email saying, you know, your order's arrived, it just makes it feel so legit. And I'm like completely torn. So I have bought one piece of software this way and it works like perfectly. It's the proper software. But yeah, I just feel a bit dirty every time I open it. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the murky world of knockoff software.
It's kind of funny, actually. Like, I guess I'm a bit weird on this one, maybe. I would rather see someone like completely steal software and not pay anything for it than to pay a third party that's profiting off other people's work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. So like, as you might know, I used to be software engineer, quote unquote, full time. And one of, you know, so they have an IT department at the big company I worked at. And one of their primary concerns, you know, one of the reasons that they locked down people's computers was because they were worried about people installing pirated software. Because a lot of pirated software comes with backdoors built into it.
Yes.
You know, yep. So like a hole that will allow, you know, the person that cracked that software to get into your computer and, you know, do whatever they want with it, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure we've all done that sort of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, downloading cracks to software, and you'd get this really sort of keygen Windows file, and it would play some really bad MIDI music, and it's cracking the software for you, and it's like, what the hell else is this thing doing? Yeah.
Yeah, and like doing that's actually pretty safe, because that way you're like generating a false key for otherwise legitimate software. But when you're like downloading fully pirated software, you have no way of knowing what's in there, you know? And like when you buy software from like Autodesk or Adobe, like you're banking on their reputation that there's no dodgy stuff in there, right? But yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that, like, you know, I think is like genuinely dangerous about getting dodgy software.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I feel scalded now. Okay.
Yes. Bad boy, Craig. Era. Bad boy. Yeah. You know, like I don't know, man.
For evaluation purposes.
That's... Yes. You know, I totally do get that. Like, there's some software that you want to try out, and then there's no way to actually try it legitimately, and you're like, really, I have to pay $1,500 just to try this out.
Yeah.
And yeah, also like the cost of some software is very prohibitive for small businesses. But also our sense of what's expensive has changed. You know, I used to think of SolidWorks as really expensive, and it is. You know, if you wanted to buy SolidWorks back in the day, it was like $6,000 or $7,000. You know? And now Fusion 360, like I pay $650 a year for that. And every time that bill comes up, I'm like, oof, you know, I wish they would do it per month, because then I would feel a bit less, you know, oof. But I do kind of wish I could buy it for like $2,000 or something.
Yeah. It's like when Adobe did the whole Creative Cloud thing with, you know, Photoshop, Illustrator and all those things. And you just like, oh, you almost got rent in the software off them.
Yeah, and I don't know, this as I get older, that makes me a little bit more uneasy. You know, I'm a little bit more like, oh, I want this shit to keep working if I decide to become a recluse and not have internet anymore, you know. Yeah.
And not have to require the software update which they're going to push out to you.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, or you know, even worse is with Photoshop in particular, there's a version that I didn't even know about called Photoshop Elements, and that you can actually buy rather than rent, you know, so it's like $70 and then you own it, but it still needs to check in. You have to have like an Adobe account, and it still wants to be online, you know, and that pisses me off, honestly. Like I have an old version of CS6. Photoshop CS6, which doesn't work on my MacBook now because the operating system's like updated and now CS6 won't run.
Yeah.
But that I owned that. You know, I didn't have to think about it. It was just there. And yeah, part of me wishes more stuff was like that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's happened with software that I've had, again, owned it. They've now gone to a different model of, you know, a monthly purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, for maybe a year or two after, that old software will still work. But all of a sudden it doesn't. And now it says, oh, now you must purchase a monthly license. It's like, well, I purchased this once. I don't particularly want these new features.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the way things are going, yeah.
Well, the really interesting thing is that there's some hardware that's like that now. So I've been looking at this laser cutter called the Glowforge. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
Yes, I know it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a really cool little machine. So it's basically like a CO2 laser with a fairly small kind of cutting area. You can chuck it on a desk or something. And I have a bunch of uses where that would be really nice. The problem is that to control it, you have to be online. Like it only works with like a browser-based online software. Yeah. So, you know, if they have a problem with their server, you can't use it. If you have a problem with your internet, you can't use it. Like, that bugs the shit out of me. That's even worse than like software that you don't own, you know?
Yeah. And imagine, you know, nobody's on a dial-up anymore, obviously, but, you know, that's going to limit their user base, because I think it's quite easy for people to be there in their sort of the San Francisco office, and they're working for this startup, and they've got beer on tap in the fridge, and they have as many holidays as they want. So it's a very trendy place to work. But yeah, they imagine that everybody's got this, you know, 8 gig connection when the majority of people really don't. And if you're up against a deadline, you need something to happen, or something to work, and it's, I can imagine, just the worst, frustrating.
Yeah, it's super archaic, but like for CNC machines and 3D printers, I really like USB sticks and SD cards.
Yeah.
You know, just copy the data on there, chuck it on the thing, press print. Like, I like that. I like the reliability, you know, as long as I've got power, it works.
Yeah. I can see, for the listeners, I can see Aaron's got a big bunch of CDs behind him. All his music. He listens to all his music on CD still. He doesn't trust Spotify with anything.
It's kind of funny you say that, because so I previously I used Google Play Music, and Google decided that Google Play Music should no longer exist in favor of YouTube Music, right? So everyone had to migrate over. Yeah. And so, you know, I had all my collection in there. I've been on Google Play Music for like 4 years. And then it migrated me to YouTube Music. And all of a sudden, whenever you're listening to an album, each song, it's playing you the video clip version of that song.
Oh.
Not the album version. So, you know, you get like the footsteps at the start with the person walking, and then the door slams, and then, you know, it was just stupid. Really, really stupid.
You've been listening to a lot of Michael Jackson, haven't you?
Exactly. There you go. So, yeah, like all of a sudden, and I couldn't make it stop. And then one day I went in and there's like the migration process between Google Play Music and YouTube Music. And for some reason, that process happened again after I'd already moved over, except all my stuff had been taken out of Google Play Music. So all it did was delete my entire collection off YouTube.
Oh, geez.
So, like, you know, they moved me over, which sucked. And then they just deleted everything. And so now I'm a Spotify customer, you know, like.
Yeah.
But, like, that was a service I paid for, you know. Yeah. And, yeah, that does bother me that, like, you know, we trust, particularly with Autodesk and Fusion 360, you know, like all of my designs are in there, you know, like my most valuable kind of intellectual property is in there. And if they accidentally do some stupid shit like that, they could just brick my company.
Yeah.
You know,
if they're bought out and they, yeah, there's so much that can happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So that definitely does bother me. Yeah, it's interesting too. Like, I know off Practical Machinist, there are a bunch of machinists that do firearms related work, and like part of the legislation around that is that they can't host that online anywhere, so they have to have like fully offline CAD, fully offline CAM, and that's actually like a challenge for them now, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah
it's interesting. Showing my Luddite side again, right?
So how are things going with your lathe? Have you stripped that down yet? Have you got it working?
It looks way worse now than it did
when I bought it.
It's in many, many pieces. It's been fun, actually. I've been doing some work on it. So, like, I don't know if I said this last week, but it came out of a school, you know. So as you said, like, all the kids like run the everything into the chuck, you know, take chunks out of the top slide, the compound slide. So I actually did some cast iron welding for the first time ever, which was fun. So preheated all of the parts with a propane torch until they were good and hot, and then filled in all the chunks with my MIG welder, and then took them to the belt grinder and ground them down flush again. Now they look like
new.
Nice. Yeah.
Nice.
Came out great.
Hmm. So what's next on what's the next machine? What are you? Because you're always buying something new. Is it going to be, do you think, the printer?
Yeah.
The 3D printer, the resin printer, yeah.
I'm making myself wait a little bit. Just you know.
You're going to buy it anyway.
I am. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of, like, which exact printer and, you know, just wait a little bit to make myself do some more work and, you know, bring in some more cash flow and get some more shit done in the meantime.
Yes. Yeah. I bought a machine this week.
Of course you didn't.
Not a CNC machine, but it's a planar thicknesser.
Oh.
So the new house that we've got, we've ripped out the sort of oak flooring, and this stuff is ancient. and like super, super, super hard.
Right.
And it, you know, I've there's just tons and tons of this stuff, and I'm like, well, I could use these for knife handles because it's a really hard oak and it's beautiful. But what I didn't want to do is process it all. So I've got this planer thicknesser, and I'm not sure if you've seen them. It's like a desktop machine, and you can use it two ways. So one is like a normal, a normal sort of electronic planer.
Yeah,
you run things across and make things flat, but it's also got the thicknesser as well. So once you've got one flat edge, you can put it on almost like a revolving belt, a conveyor belt, and it'll go through and it'll then plane the top, and you can adjust the size so you can get the exact thickness that you need.
Yeah. So I don't know whether the terminology in Europe is different, but here we would call that a jointer for making the one flat surface on the bottom, and then a planer for doing the flat surface on the top.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably call it a jointer in a way. It can do that as well, but right. If you think of the top side, if you use up against a fence and you use the joining edge, I suppose that would be the sort of the jointer functionality, I suppose.
Right.
You can go that, you know, the non-joining edge. So for example, if it were to be floors, you know, the top or the bottom, you can do it that way too.
Oh, it does the side?
So it'll do the side against the fence, or you can just put it through.
Oh, that's
basically
weird.
It'll do all four. You know, so each time would be separate. You wouldn't do two at once, but you can all four sides to make sure you get things.
I've got no fucking idea what that is then. Like over here, that I've never even seen something like that. Normally, you would have a jointer which just does the bottom, and you'd have a planer which just does the top. I've never seen one that does the side that's not like a router table or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about the same machine, but all you need to do is use that fence and put one of the flat edge against the fence, and then, you know, you've got a 90 on the other angle. So
oh, it's a good idea, though, like to reprocess all those floorboards. That's smart.
Yes, but this thing is the noisiest machine I've ever heard in my life. It's ridiculous. So it works almost like a router when it goes, you know, super, super fast. But yeah, it's just noisy and it just sprays out dust. It's, ugh. So yeah, it's only to be used outdoors, this one. But yeah, it's going to help me process all this wood really quickly for handles, which would be nice.
Did you buy a metal detector?
I didn't. I've heard that I should have, I know.
Yeah, because those old boards are probably full of like bits of broken nails and stuff. Once you chip a blade.
That's it.
Yeah. You're going to be sad.
Yeah. No, we've been pretty careful. It's weird. We've pulled up these floors, but I'd say maybe 50% of it is like perfect, you know, and it's just really, really nice wood. So, yeah, it's going to be a real shame not to use it. And the fact that we've managed to pull it up, and I'm pretty sure we've got all the nails as we've done it.
Right.
I'm pretty sure we're going to be good. So that's going to be a nice, range of knives coming out soon, which is nice.
Yeah, so my buddies Tim and Nick at Frank Brothers Guitar Co., they have some like really nice old school woodworking machinery. Big old jointer, and their planer is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. It's probably 3 feet wide. Like 3.5 feet deep, and then the infeed and outfeed tables are on top of that. Like it's bigger. And the whole thing's cast iron. They had to use a forklift to put it in place. It's got to weigh like a couple of thousand pounds. And this thing howls when you start it up. It sounds exactly like an air raid siren.
Yeah.
It's utterly terrifying. Woodworking machinery scares the shit out of me, honestly.
Which is crazy to think, fabricating metal has to be more dangerous, surely, than wood.
Well, the rule of thumb is woodworkers get stuff cut off. Metalworkers get stuff torn off. lathes can be really dangerous. You know, like if you're using a metalworking lathe and you're polishing by hand on it, which you have to be really careful about. Or if you've got long hair.
Especially that long hair of yours.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you're wearing sleeves or gloves, don't do those things. I've seen a couple of very nasty videos where, I saw one video in particular where a guy gets his hand caught on a lathe while he's wearing a glove. It wraps his arm around, and then it basically tears his arm off at the elbow. It literally tears the elbow joint apart. and pulls his arm completely off. And then his arm is going around with the chuck while he's standing in front of the lathe watching his arm go around with the chuck. Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. Interesting enough, he actually got it reattached.
What kind of websites do you go to see this shit?
Well, that was on Reddit. You know what, man? Every once in a while, you've got to like re-expose yourself to the realities of what can happen when shit goes wrong. You know?
Yeah.
And I have been in the unfortunate situation of seeing a pretty serious industrial accident firsthand. I had to rescue a friend of mine after he took off most of his left hand with a table saw. And yeah, it's not nice. It's really, really not nice, you know, and you have to be careful.
Yeah. Table saws scare the hell out of me.
As they should.
More than anything else in the shop, I'd imagine. It's either a table saw or the polishing machines, you know, with
The buffers.
The mop on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was using an old cabinet maker's saw, which, you know, big cast iron, no thought to safety, you know. And he was using it with no blade guard, no splitting, no splitter, no riving knife. He was using a dado stack, which are illegal in Europe. Yeah. And he was cutting a blind dado by hand by lowering the bit of wood onto the blade. So he was doing some very inadvisable things. And unfortunately, he paid for that in a very, very concrete sense. But yeah,
did he actually lose his hand?
He lost most of four fingers, and part of most of four fingers, part of his thumb. They were able to rebuild his index finger and his thumb, so he has those functional. And then he's got three wigglers.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it's very unfortunate. Like, obviously, he had a much worse time of that than I did because I was just a witness. But, yeah, even being a witness to something like that, I took, like, 2 or 3 days off work after that. I was just like, you know.
Yeah. Have you seen the saw stops with that sort of sensing technology, they call it, and you see people putting the hot dog sausage up to the blade and the brake comes
on? They are amazing. They are amazing. I think that like all table saws should be saw stops. I actually said that on YouTube on a saw stop video on a guy that was demonstrating his saw stop in his shop. And I had all these people jumping in being like, oh, you shouldn't want the government to regulate. And I was like,
oh, Jesus.
Fucking assholes. Like, you come back and talk to me after you've seen someone try to find their own fucking fingers, you know? Like,
people.
Yeah.
The worst.
Bastards.
The worst.
Yeah, but the saw stops are very cool.
But they're pretty destructive. That brake is pretty destructive on the blade, I think, isn't it? And it's
The blade's trash. The brake unit and the blade are trash. But like, that's like $200.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
Yeah, much cheaper than fingers.
Yeah, that's what she said.
Yeah. Oh,
wrong podcast.
Oh. Yeah.
So have you been unfortunate to have any bad... I've been very fortunate. I haven't really had any bad accidents in the shop. I've cut myself with knives. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, not in the shop, but just in my own kitchen with my own knives and other people's knives quite badly. But never actually a sort of an industrial accident. Have you come close?
I've come close a few times, unfortunately. So I've been witness to a few very close calls and had two close calls myself, one with a table saw. One with another cabinet maker's saw that was in a shared shop that I was in. And again, like no safety equipment. And I was cutting a square piece of like 6mm, like 1/4 inch MDF. And the back of the saw blade caught the side of the piece of timber, and I had like a kickback, so the whole thing came back at me. But during that process, it nearly put my left hand, because my hand was on the bit of wood and I had quite a bit of clearance between my hand and the blade, but it moved the whole thing through the blade. And so it nearly put my left hand through the blade, and then it chucked the bit of wood at me, and hit my left leg, and then the wood bounced off me and embedded itself in the door behind me.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so I had
And that's what scares me about table saws, more than my fingers touching the blade. It's that kickback of throwing something back at me. And again, with buffing wheels, it's that same. Well, it's the same action of just picking something up and throwing it back over the top.
Yeah, and it's super dangerous with buffing wheels if you're working on knives, because you're getting a knife chucked at you. That's not a good time. Yeah,
it's generally the last thing you do as well. You're buffing it at the end, you know. So you've got your bevels, and you know it's
pointy.
This is a dangerous weapon which could be thrown at you, sort of. Yeah, at a ridiculous speed.
Yeah, and so like I'll say, you know, I hadn't used a table saw a lot. You know, it's quite possible I was doing something incorrectly, but that saw was also monumentally unsafe. And there are a lot of saws floating around there like that. Like if you had a splitter, which is like the little shark fin that goes up behind the blade,
then
the wood couldn't have gone left into the rising teeth of the blade. You know, if it had a splitter, it would have been the same thing. If it had a guard, then my hand couldn't have touched the blade. And you know, for the kickback, if you had the anti-kickback poles, which are like the little pointy teeth that kind of drop onto the wood, then you can't have kickback either. So yeah, like if you just buy a table saw and then you leave it with all the safety gear on it, they're a lot safer. But like most woodworkers don't tend to use them like that, you know?
Yeah. No, I find that with a lot of sort of safety devices on machines, a lot of them are sort of bolt-on afterthoughts as well, and they literally just get in the way, and they're a real pain. But yeah, when you know you need them when they're there, and if they're not there to protect you at the time, it can be costly.
Seriously, yeah. And then the other one I had was actually while changing the spindle on my CNC machine on Millie. So the easiest way to replace the spindle is actually to do it with the power on, and you move the machine. So basically the spindle is like a cylindrical cartridge that drops out of the bottom of the spindle housing, so in the Z-axis. So what you do is you put a bit of foam on your table, you drop the machine all the way down, loosen the bolts on the bottom of the spindle cartridge, take the bolts out, and then raise the machine up. And as you do, the spindle cartridge stays in place and just kind of falls out the bottom.
Right.
And the reason this is important is because the spindle cartridge weighs like 100 pounds. So it's not like it's super easy just to, you know, hold it with one hand while you're putting the bolts in. And then to put the new cartridge in, you do the reverse. So you have the Z axis all the way up, you put the cartridge in place on the table, and then you lower the axis very carefully down over the cartridge. And basically, I had lowered it down in place, and I was doing some work on the top end of the spindle, kind of getting it aligned, and had my hand in a pinch point, and I didn't think about that. And what happened was I had lowered the machine too much. It was pushing against the foam with a lot of force, and that was fine for the first second, but then the servo drives that are, you know, driving that axis have like an overload protection built into them.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it overloaded after a couple of seconds and released the power on that axis. And so all of the foam and the force actually pushed the axis back up by about an inch while my hand was in a spot that would have gotten snipped off or, you know, squished a bit. And luckily my reactions were very fast and I yanked my hand out. But if I hadn't have done that, then he could have been calling me stumps. So you know, working on machines with the power on when you're doing maintenance is generally a bad idea. And if you do it when it's on, you have to be really careful about where your hands are. So I've definitely been more careful since then. Yeah, safety. Do it.
Yep, definitely, definitely. And even down to, you know, respirators, eye protection, those kind of things. You don't sort of think there's not an immediate accident that's waiting to happen there. A lot of these
with
things,
eye protection,
eye protection maybe, but especially, you know, the respiratory stuff.
Yes, yeah. It's,
you don't feel it. You know, you may be a bit wheezy the next day and think, oh, I should have put something on yesterday. But it's gradual, you know, and
if you're grinding something and breathing shit in, and you're breathing enough shit in that you're feeling a bit wheezy the next day, don't do that. Stop doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure you're not doing that, Craig, but you know, as a public service announcement, like, don't fucking do that. That's going to end your life early. You know? Yeah. The probably the funniest if we can say that, the funniest industrial accident that I've been witness to.
We should get some chart music for this. And in at number 10.
Yeah, seriously. Yakety sax or something. So when I was working at a guitar company in Australia, this is just one of those things where looking back on it, you're like, what the fuck, you know? So the head of the shop, his name was Klaus, and he was this serious German guy, and he did not have a complete finger on either hand. Which, if that's the guy that's the head of your shop, like, you need to be, you know, and he's the one, like, teaching the new guys like me how to use the machinery.
Oh, geez.
Like, that's, you know, in hindsight, I should have just been like, nah, I'm good. And I should have just fucking left, you know? Yeah. So this guy is teaching me how to use the jointer, you know, and they have a big jointer. This thing is probably 8 feet long.
Wow.
You know, and so for those that don't know, a jointer is basically a big flat table with a cylindrical cutting blade in the middle. And so when you feed a piece of wood over the top of that cutting blade, it cuts the bottom of the wood flat. So you can make like a flat plank.
Pretty much like the planer jointer we talked about earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And
pretty much, yeah.
They had what's called a mutton chop guard on theirs, which is, it looks like a, you know, a pork chop that kind of swivels out of the way. And if you're cutting a relatively narrow piece of wood, say, you know, their jointer was like a foot and a half wide, and he was cutting, you know, jointing a piece that was only 6 inches wide. So that potentially leaves a lot of the blade exposed when that guard swings out of the way.
Yeah.
And he was leaning right over the machine, wearing a loose t-shirt, and the dust collection system was running. And it pulled the edge of his flapping t-shirt toward the blade, and it caught his t-shirt, and he got slammed face down immediately over the blade onto the piece of wood. And it sucked his whole t-shirt in, like ripped the whole thing off his body, just straight into the machine. And somehow he was fine, like no injury at all after that. And he stood up and he turned around and looked at me, and he still had both the sleeves of his t-shirt on. So he's bare-chested with just the two sleeves left on. And he kind of stood there for a second, then he just went, oh, at least it wasn't another finger. And then he went and got a new t-shirt and he went back to work.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Seriously, man. Like, if that happened to me, I'd be taking a week off.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I'd be reevaluating my life choices at that point. And this, it did not faze him at all. And that's the kind of person you have to really worry about, you know?
Doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, as evidenced by the fact that he didn't have a complete finger, you know? Like, you don't want people like that in your shop. You don't want people like that.
And he had a spare t-shirt in the shop. He knew this was coming one day.
Dude, yeah, yeah, as I said, much younger Aaron, I was just like, oh, you know, I should have been like, later, boys, out of here, you know.
I remember back in school, this is how long ago this was, and we were in the science lab, and the science lab had like power outlets on each desk, and they were up on this like wedge kind of thing, and for some reason we had like little tongs. What are they called?
Tweezers.
Little tweezers,
yeah.
For whatever we were doing. And there was a girl in the class, and I still remember it, Jamie Summers. And she had this like the longest blonde hair, like, you know, really, really long. And we all heard this big poof. We looked around and her hair is sticking up out of the, you know, 6 foot up in the air. And we're like, what the hell happened? She said, well, the plug that was in, and in the UK, we have these 3-pin plugs with the longer earth and the two lives. But the earth is longer. And the reason the earth is longer, because the plug sockets have like covers on the live and neutral.
Right.
So unless the earth goes in, you can't put anything in.
Right.
But what that does mean, if you just pull out the plug just by just a little bit, the live and the neutral are exposed to something and going underneath.
Yep.
And she couldn't get the plug out. So for some reason, she had these metal tweezers in her hand and decided she'd try and wedge the plug out from underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So the plug came out just enough for these metal tweezers to hit a live. And I just remember that in school and just thinking, Jesus, some people, they just, no matter if there's any sort of health and safety thing there, sometimes you just, your mind just goes and you just need to get that little job done. That's all you're focused on.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was just get that plug out the socket. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And I just remember the poof, and the hair just standing up on edge, and like the tears. And the...
Well, and that's the thing that gets you, right? Is it's always like, you know, yeah, as you said, you've got a job to do, and you know, yeah, the machine's running, but I can see that little bit's hanging off. I'll just grab it. Hmm. You know, that's the thing that gets you. You know, that not having that respect for the machine. So that's why I was saying, like, every once in a while I go and watch some, like, health and safety videos or, like, industrial accident videos, and you come away a little scarred, but then you don't fuck with things, and, you know, you're not...
Yeah.
You go to...
That's your excuse, you sicko.
No.
You sicko, that's your excuse.
Trust me, it makes me feel pretty queasy. Even honestly, just even just talking about my friend losing his fingers makes me feel a little like, oh, yeah, maybe I shouldn't go to the shop today, you know. But like, yeah, it's the reality. You have to be really careful.
Well, that went dark. I didn't expect the show to be so dark today.
Yeah,
we started off quite chipper and quite happy, and now we're talking about
Well, you know what? You know what? We all deal with dangerous things, so let's just all be careful. We'll all have a good day. We'll all be careful. We'll be fine.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to finish the show. Everybody, please be careful.
Stay safe. Yeah.
Stay safe.
Have a good
week,
everyone.
Speak to you soon. Bye bye.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.